Hello and welcome to Gonservation Conversations. That's a bit of a tongue twister. That's what I was trying to say, a tongue twister. I'm Kerry Levy and I'm a conservationist. Well, what we're going to do is we're going to talk to Honolulu. That's in Hawaii. That's the other side of the world. I'm going to bed. They're all getting up. And our special guest is none other than Nathan Eagle, the climate reporter and a photographer who works on the Honolulu Civil Beat, which sounds like an incredible sort of, I don't know, sounds like a 70s cop show or something. I love it. It means that they're policing the streets and getting on with a serious business. Nathan, hello. How are you?
Aloha. How are you doing all the way over there, 7,000 miles away?
Oh, I'm okay. I'm a little bit tired, if I'm honest. How are you, though? You're bright and bushy-tailed, aren't you? This is morning for you.
I'm still in the process of caffeinating, so I'm not quite there yet, but I'm working on it.
Okay. Well, you know, I actually gave up caffeine a while ago. It's a weird thing to give up, but I don't even know if I could handle a cup of coffee now. It might be just too much. See, this is what happens when you get older. You get hysterical and strange. I'm so happy to be talking to you because serendipity, Ralph and I have always said, plays a major part in anything that happens in this world that's good. Things happen serendipitously. And actually, you're a serendipitous moment. I must get rid of all these tough words. It's really killing me. But I just want to find out a little about you, what you're doing, because you are interested in a particular species of bird, aren't you?
That's absolutely right. So, yeah, a little bit about myself. I'm the climate change reporter here over at Honolulu Civil Beat. I've been doing that for a little while now. I've been in Hawaii the last 10, 15 years, covering the environment quite a bit. And that kind of led me to this little green-yellow bird that's in the middle of the forest, parts of the forest that you can't even reach out here in Hawaii, called the kiwiqiu.
Okay, the kiwiqiu. I don't know. There sounds some real subtlety in the way you said that. It didn't. When I look at it, I think it's a kiwiqiu. But you seem to have some inflection there. Is there a Hawaiian inflection? Is it on the W? How does that quite sound again?
Yeah, I pronounce it the kiwiqiu, which I looked and actually did it. They had an official Hawaiian naming several years ago. The original name of it was actually lost over time, as has happened, especially in Hawaiian, which is such an oral language, and how it's passed down. So I looked it up, and that's how they were pronouncing it. It was good enough for me. It's how all the bird nerds out in the woods pronounced it as well. And so kiwiqiu, yeah.
Okay, well, it's interesting. I would say, well, it's pretty careless to lose your name, but at the same time, you know, we shouldn't be too hard on this little fella, should we? Because it's going through a pretty tough time, isn't he?
Yeah, it's having the roughest of times. Not doing well at all. They're down to their last little range up on the side of Haleakala, which is the big mountain on Maui, an old dormant volcano, and they're down to, estimates are between like 40-some of these birds left and 300, or just over 300. So we'll call it about 150, split the difference. It's not looking too good for these guys, and they don't really have anywhere to go. They've had to kind of keep moving up in altitude, kind of keep going up the mountain. So now they're, you know, about 7,000 feet because the mosquito line has kind of steadily increased with climate change. As the planet's getting warmer, the mosquitoes are going higher and higher, and that's no good for them because they are carrying avian malaria, and that's what's really decimating their population.
So did this story for you first start with the mosquitoes and the climate change, and you saw this, or were you always into birds?
That's a good question. I think I was a birder in denial for a long time. At least that's what my wife Alana tells me. There was a trip, though, 2 years ago. I went out to Papahanaumo Kuakea. There's a Hawaiian word of the day for you. We'll work on that pronunciation later. It's a marine national monument it covers the northwestern Hawaiian islands. So we're talking hundreds and or even maybe 1,000 or 1,300 miles northwest of Honolulu, where I am, in the main Hawaiian islands. And so I went out there for a reporting trip, and that's where I really grew a lot more connected to the birds. Seabirds predominantly, but also some very, very endangered ducks and also a miller bird. And so one of the biologists on that trip was actually on this trip in the woods. But that's where I kind of grew more, way, way, way more connected with the birds, to the point I think I shared with you earlier a photo where a booby landed on my head during an interview with the Fish and Wildlife Service. So we kind of bonded, the birds and I, and when I got back, you know, I was like, well, we've done a lot now on seabirds. What's going on with our forest birds? We hear over and over, Hawaii is the extinction capital of the world. Extinction capital of the world. More species going extinct here than anywhere else. So I was like, well, what does that mean, though? Like, and what species are we really talking about? Let's put a face on this. And that's when I learned of the KiwiQ from a worker out way out in Kure Atoll, who I met on that previous reporting trip, said, hey, there's this little forest bird on Maui, the KiwiQ, also called the Maui parrotbill, which is maybe easier for some folks, that's going extinct. It's going extinct quickly, and we're trying to do something about it. Would you be interested in looking at this story? And I said, absolutely, let's do this.
So that's interesting. I just want to just go back a little bit, because you came out with a line, which is something that I discovered, that line when we were writing the books, that Hawaii is the extinction capital of the world. And you think there's so many things that people want to be the capital of, you know, the type of capital. And for something like this, it's terrifying, isn't it? Especially if you're living there. And what we say over here at the moment, I've been talking to a lot of birders in the last few days about some projects that are going on over here. And what we're saying is that we don't have the same sort of extinction problems. We have local extinctions, but what we're really missing is the abundance of birds. And this seems to be the first step to extinction, is the loss of the abundance of birds, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's something we've unfortunately been more just documenting the demise of out here than anything.
Yeah, I mean, it's what I find is amazing is all of these birds, or so many creatures in this world, survive on people taking a personal interest. Yeah, there are, you find this small groups trying to protect. Of course, we've got wonderful organizations like BirdLife International, and then all the relevant bird groups that work for BirdLife or are part of BirdLife in different countries. Like, I think in America, it's the Audubon Society, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do they take a pretty big hand and help out in Hawaii?
Absolutely. American Bird Conservancy is probably the biggest. They were up there on the mountain with everyone. Big reason that project even happened. They partner, you know, with our state and federal agencies to do what they can, and also partnering, you know, with Maui Forest Bird Recovery Project, a nonprofit that's local over there. Yes, they play a big role out here.
Okay, so there is support as well, but it's also, isn't it the passion of the people on the ground that helps that more and more people get added on, but it's still a small amount of people considering the job that needs to be done, and a lot of them are doing it because they care. And I think that caring and that passion for wildlife, it's kind of something we've said about being a conservationist and being an alternative conservationist. One day I'll get it right. But it's that fact that we can all do something in this world, however big, however small, we can do something that makes a difference. And actually, what we need to do is get this world delivering some compassion to wildlife again, because that's the only way through this, isn't it? Because it does seem as though an awful lot of governments have not got behind this whole environmental crisis that we're in at the moment.
You're absolutely right. And so I think a big reason for that is there's not enough members of the public perhaps pressuring the government to care about these. That's where I felt journalism could play a role. It's like, I could at least shine a light on this problem. It's up to the public. They can do whatever they want with that information, but it's hard to know if you want to take action on something that you don't know exists as a problem. And so the QVQ, you know, the only place they are alive, the only place they exist now is pretty much off limits and unreachable to anyone who wants to go see them or could. It's not like they're in your backyard and it's like, oh, I see two or three fewer cardinals now or a couple less doves and I should worry about that. No, these haven't been seen for decades. And so their extinction could happen without so much as people even noticing. And that's I think, pretty tragic. I think objectively I can say that that's tragic.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. But I think there's also something here that you hit on there as well about people wanting to help and you're shining a light. At the end of the day, what I've found is that a lot of people don't know how to help. And that because we're in this age of vicarious living, almost a voyeuristic age where everybody's watching something on YouTube or something on Twitter or Instagram, or, you know, we're surrounded by social media being very instantaneous, giving you a buzz, giving you something, but you get something back, supposedly, for your devotion to watching. People have lost the ability to understand how to physically help in the real world, but also have got bored about the idea that you just pay in money to some project, but may not see the results. Like with the big organizations, you pay your money, and then that money may go to saving a bird somewhere in the world, or it may go to pay the secretary's wage just down the hall. So I think that really conservation needs to find a way of showing people how they are part of these projects. And I think it's the big problem for the 21st century is how do we engage people to make them feel a part of something? Because all this social media, all it's doing is fooling everyone into thinking they're part of something. So if we can make people feel a part of something for real, then that becomes tangible.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you had mentioned it, or perhaps it was on your website, that you got to do more than just click like on a social media post if you really want to do something about it. Hannah Mounts, who's the head of the Maui Forest Bird Recovery Project, someone who I think you would probably consider a conservationist. Hey, not too bad.
Hey, that's not shoddy.
she was ready with an answer when I asked her. You know, it's often a question for the end of my stories or end of interviews. I want to make sure, well, okay, we've informed the public, but what can they do? So I asked her, well, hey, well, if the public reads this and they want to do something, what do they do? And she said, well, of course, donations are helpful. It funds things like the translocation effort they were doing up there for the QVQ. But also, she said the most spectacular way is volunteering and putting trees in the ground. They spent 10 to 15 years restoring the forest on the other side of Haleakala, so they had a place that was suitable to move some of these birds that they captured to try to establish an insurance population. And so volunteering, putting trees in the ground. She also encouraged folks to write letters to their lawmakers. Just do that over and over, because sometimes laws need change or funding needs to be upped, as is often the case. And she said that's where the public can really make a difference.
You see, this is exactly what we need. People coming up with solutions to how to satisfy the public's need to be part of something and understand that they're part of something. The other thing about writing letters to authorities and things is sometimes also people will do, I've seen a blanket letter that you can just download and sign, and the work's done for you in a kind of a way. We have to make things easy for people, because people have become lazy, and it's trying to shake them up a bit and get them to take notice, which is why we love what you've been doing. And how long has she been on this project now?
Hannah's been on the project, I think she said mid-2000s she first started over there, and it has just kind of worked, I think, first as an intern or something like that, and then now as the director of it. And so I guess over a decade would be the amount of time she's been working just with that.
Okay. And is she completely passionate about this project? From what I'm reading on the Maui Forest Bird Recovery Project, this is a passionate project for everyone involved. And by the sounds of it, she is too, isn't she?
Yeah, I mean, I spent, you know, 10 showerless days in the woods up there with them. For each and every person that was up there, wildlife biologists and volunteers and things like that, this was not just a job or a paycheck. This was definitely a passion and a calling for them.
It's a vocational thing in a way, isn't it? It's suddenly it takes over your life, these sort of projects. I've done a bit of traveling around and seeing projects and going and helping out. And the thing that always amazes me is that these big organizations may be in front of them and are raising money and other people are chipping in money. And at the end of the day, suddenly you're left in a situation where it's just a small group of people. I remember being out on the steppe of Kazakhstan, which is a pretty big place, I have to say. And the people that I was went to see that were working on the sociable lapwing project to try and save that from extinction and trying to, well, they were trying to discover exactly what was wrong with the bird. And I just remember sitting on this small little mound in the middle of the steppe, and there's four or five people just looking as far as the eye can see, looking out for birds. And what was incredible was they found them. They would find, I mean, how even the most experienced bird watchers might find it really hard to see birds like that at such great distance. But they suddenly go, yep, I've got the two that we knew would be nesting over there. And they were like about half a mile away. It was incredible to watch. And it's this passion that always is the same. It's always a small group of people. Did you come back different after your 10 showerless days?
Absolutely. This is one of, I think, maybe two or possibly three trips that has had and will have like a lasting effect on me, for sure. The Papahanaumokuakea trip was the one that stands out as the first kind of coming back different and being more aware of, you know, just the consumption that we have and plastics and how things last. And this one was very much a getting in tune with our native forests. And so it's a part of, I mean, if you picture postcards of Hawaii and things like that, it's often our sandy beaches and the beautiful waters, but it's not usually forests. You don't think of being cold. You don't think of it being super rainy necessarily, or all those things combined in these beautiful forests. And so it was mostly ohia trees there. And I think one of the veterinarians who was partnering from San Diego Zoo described it as prehistoric when she walked out there for the first time. And I kind of agreed with that. The forest floor is just covered with native ferns that have been around for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. The tree canopy is all ohia. And you just don't see forests like that at lower elevations or other parts of the state.
Is there something when you're in an environment like that where you know that hardly anyone goes there? Is there something that feels really quite magical and you've been transported? And then does that then make you think, but this is how the world used to be. We used to have a lot of places like this.
Absolutely. It's one of the things that's so important to me about firsthand reporting and just going there and experiencing it, because you're going to come back with things that are far more than the answers you got from the questions you asked of the folks there. Sometimes you just need to be there physically and let a place affect you so that you can come back and hopefully put something together that resonates with the public. But you know, when you mentioned, I think it was the word magical, I mean, the sound of the forest is another thing that will stick with me. You're hearing, there were, I think, six native species left on Maui of forest birds, down from 60 or 70. So we're down, the Kiwi-Kiu is one of these six, but all six were in this forest. And their sounds, their songs, their chirps and chips are what fill the forest. And you just, after 10 days, that's just the only thing you're really hearing, and you get very used to it. You kind of slow down a little, notice little things. There was a lot of intense hiking. You know, it's a very steep slope. It's super muddy. There's no real trails. And then it's a lot of intense waiting, where you're looking for the Kiwi-Kiu to capture. And as a way of helping you disconnect, there's also no cell phone service. That's helpful as well. And just really taking in and appreciating where you are. And that helps, I think, in turn, understand why they're doing the work that they're doing.
This obviously inspired you in a certain way to tell the story, to get people involved, as you said, to shine a light on the subject. So what the hell made you get in touch with us? What was it? How did this happen? Why are we talking now? I don't really understand. Tell me all.
I guess it does seem fun. It's like, well, you get back from a reporting trip and it's like, well, let's think of the place that's absolutely farthest away. We should get in touch with someone there. perhaps in England. We'll look in England. No, it was coming back. So I went, you know, armed with all the cameras and 360 and drones and everything I could think of to tell the story in a multimedia way. But that still wasn't quite enough to satisfy me in my thinking that I wanted a broader audience for this. It's hard to get the general public to care sometimes about a little bird, a dinky little bird, as Hannah puts it, that's in the middle of the forest that they'll never see. And so art came to mind. Let's do some art with this. And then I thought, well, I'm sitting at home and on my coffee table is a copy of Extinct Boids, which I've lugged around to the last five places I've lived. I say lugged because you did put together quite a big book, and I love it. And there's a reason I take it from place to place. So I'm flipping through that, and I look and I see the apapane and the kohikoi and all these other Hawaii birds that are still just barely hanging on, and as well as many that are extinct. Of course, the name of the book. But I didn't see the kiwiqiu, and I thought, wow, I wonder if Ralph Steadman would draw us a kiwiqiu. And I thought, probably not, but hey, I'll kick myself for never asking. And so I remember my wife Alana's encouragement saying, you sent that letter, right? You asked them at least, right? I was like, I'm getting to it. And so I fired off that email to, I think it was, you know, a very general address I found online. And I tried to say what I was doing, and as we've discussed, and I think you folks responded within 24 hours, a very serendipitous moment, as you put it earlier.
Well, yeah, I have to say, you know, it wasn't because we were bored and had nothing to do or anything like that. I mean, Ralph gets a lot of requests and things for an awful lot of things, but Sadie, Ralph's daughter, who is also the keeper of the castle, as it were, and organizes everything. In fact, I call her the organizer of obfuscation.
That's great.
I don't know what it is. I love seeing these words on paper and I hate saying them. But she just immediately phoned me the next morning, just when you'd gone to bed, I think.
Yeah.
She just said, because if things come in to do with, you know, wildlife and animals and things, she just gives me a call and we decide what's good, what's not. And, you know, in life, I've tried to find a way to say yes to things because that can be really interesting. And I think Sadie feels the same as well. When something comes up, you just go, God, we haven't done it. Okay, I'm going through the book. Okay. No, we haven't done it. How the hell did we not do it, say, in the second book, Nextinction? There are so many birds, though. And to be honest, all the Hawaiian birds confused the hell out of me and Ralph as to whether this one is extinct or it wasn't, and the names looked a little similar. And then Ralph would draw a page with some extinct birds on, but then some that weren't, and, you know, left to our own devices individually. We made a bit of a pig's ear of it at times, but it doesn't matter because the sentiment is the same. You know, we're bringing them all back to life on the island we created within the books. But that's another story. So when Sadie got in touch the next morning, she said, what do you think? And our first thought was, would Ralph want to draw a bird again? Because we did two books on birds. We moved on to Critical Critters about the rest of the wildlife. Was it something that had been left behind in the past? And Sadie went and spoke to him, and I had a word with him during the day as well. And then Sadie said, yeah, he's doing it now. And she sent me some photos straight away. And it's what I love about it is it's such a tender portrait. And watching him work vicariously, again, as we were talking about earlier, through Sadie's iPad and what have you, it was just such a wonderful moment to come out of bird retirement. So, you know, it was wonderful that you got in touch. And it just shows sometimes you've got to just get out there and present yourself. I mean, I did the same with Ralph, actually, 7 or 8 years ago. I was doing a show called Ghosts of Gone Birds, and we were getting 125 artists, and I was trying to get all my favourite artists to be in it. And Ralph had always been an inspiration and a hero to me. And a friend of mine said, oh, I've got his email. You know, drop him an email and see what happens, you know. And just remember that just when you've given up hope, something wonderful may drop in your inbox. Anyway, I fired off this email, didn't hear anything. And then suddenly after 2 months or so, I got this email from Ralph Steadman. And it said, I have no idea what you want. It sounds intriguing. We must talk. Then suddenly, literally 2 minutes later, the phone rang and it was Ralph. And he didn't introduce himself or say, hello, what's your name? How do you say your name? It's spelled C-E-R-I. He just started reading me a story, something that he'd written. And it had all these characters in it, and he did all the voices. And for about 20 minutes, I just laid down on my couch, almost like therapy, as Ralph Steadman, previously unknown to me in the actual physical world, read me a story. And at the end of it, he said, right, so what do I have to do? And I said, well, just pick an extinct bird from this list. And at 6 o'clock that evening, 3 birds arrived in email. And I went, no, you didn't. You only had to do one. I mean, they're fantastic, but you only had to do one. He said, well, I quite like doing these. I've been looking for something interesting to do. I might do another one. And I was going, well, you really don't need to. Anyway, the long and the short of it is we ended up chatting every day. And he did, I think it was 110. And in this exhibition, we had this amazing room, which was like an annex. And it almost felt church-like because it was like a bit of a curved roof. And we hung all the pictures just with little bulldog clips and on the wall on pins. And it was just an amazing array of these birds. And that was it, really. We've pretty much been working ever since together, and that's been 8 years now. So yeah, I love the serendipity of you just going, you know what, and your wife saying to you, just send the email, because you never know what you're going to get in return. If you do things with a good heart, good things can happen.
Couldn't agree more. And I do appreciate that nudge she gave me.
Well, you know, that's the way it works, you know. So what was it like when the drawing turned up in your inbox?
I was in disbelief. I mean, I think we first chatted, I want to say maybe the beginning of November. Does that sound about right? And it's been kind of surreal ever since. You know, here I am, a journalist out in Hawaii who's had your book and Ralph's book for some time, who was inspired to become a journalist from Hunter S. Thompson and his work with Ralph that really brought that to light. And then here I am at work covering this species after a really epic trip in the woods on Maui. And I get this illustration from Ralph Steadman. And you know, it was just incredible. I think the word you used that really captured it, that I felt as well, was that it was tender. It was a very tender portrait. Maybe for others who are more familiar with some of his earlier work, it doesn't have that feel. And it that, I think, surprised me at first. And then to come around and say, oh, yeah, actually, this really captures the QVQ and kind of where it's at right now. So it was just really, really wild. And then I became very anxious to find out the best way to incorporate it into our multimedia project. And there we are.
No, well, you know, I think it's wonderful that you react like that, because that's what I think Ralph's art can do. I think it can inspire. And I think people go, oh, my gosh, because it is. It's got something that head is extraordinary, the line in it, and also the eye in it. And I say this a lot to Ralph, but with this one in particular, I said, the eye. He said, yes. I said, well, it's just black with a little white dot. And he went, yeah, there's another line round the black as well. I said, yeah, but it's got life. It follows me round the room. How do you do it? I can draw an eye 1,000 times in a day, and it will never, ever have that pathos in it. And I think that's the extraordinary thing. That's why I think somebody like Ralph, he creates something magical when he draws.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny you mentioned the eye. That's what really jumped out at me and held me the longest, for sure. And it's also just part of what made me so excited to be able to share that then with the public, because it was exactly what I'd hoped for, beyond what I'd hoped for, to be frank, to pull in members of the public who might not otherwise care about this species or its plight.
Now that you're up and running and the articles are out and the pictures out there for people to see, what's the reaction been like and how do you move forward with everything?
The reaction's been phenomenal. We've been really lucky to have a lot of good responses. We had some record donations to kind of keep our work going, which was really cool. We had a lot of just positive emails and chats and texts saying, hey, just really love what you did there. That's been really reassuring and encouraging, because you put everything into it and then you don't know until those moments after it's published, whether it resonated or connected at all. So that part's been really great. The part that has been really hard, and what will be an upcoming story, is the reality of the QEQ that were translocated, that were moved from the one side of Haleakala to their new habitat on the other. Those damn mosquitoes have killed, I think, virtually all of them already. You know, maybe a dozen or so were released. And that's, as we've talked earlier, it's this big chunk of the population that's left. And so it's focused attention on the mosquitoes and what's being done with that. So I've shifted gears to trying to call every mosquito expert I can find and figure out what's being done from a technological standpoint and from a conservation standpoint in that regard. So that's kind of where we're at now. So it's been a roller coaster of sorts.
And what's the consensus on how to deal with avian malaria and the mosquitoes? Is there a solution?
There is, or at least there's one that's, or two that are promising and are in the works. So the bird conservationists and biologists are looking towards what's being done about human diseases, you know, dengue and things like that. They're usually a couple steps ahead, because people generally care about people first and then the birds follow. But they're basically using that kind of technology to reduce mosquito populations. And the one that I think they're going to try to push for out here in Hawaii is not a genetically modified mosquito plan, which has become very controversial, but rather it's a different thing where they're going to essentially infect some of the mosquitoes with this Wolbachia, if I'm saying it correctly, and it'll basically crash the population. And if things go well, then that will in turn reduce the amount of birds that are dying from avian malaria. So that's the plan. Where they're at now is kind of developing and breeding these mosquitoes. Then they're going to have to get a bunch of permits to actually import and export them. The import-export comes from collecting mosquitoes here, sending them to Michigan where they're working on this, and then have to get them back here to Hawaii and then release them. So they've got some time before that'll happen. They're going to do, hopefully, as early as next year, they'll be doing a whole round of like public education kind of meetings and campaigns around the state. And then we'll see where it goes from there.
And is there enough time for this project to save the QEQ?
They all say yes. They feel that the population that's up in Hanavi, the area where I was at, you know, it's stable-ish. They've removed, you know, all the other predators. It's high enough in elevation that the mosquitoes haven't reached it yet. The problem with that population there is they've run out of room in terms of the habitat, so it can't expand anymore. And so they've got a little time that'll buy them. They're going to, I think, still be doing some captive breeding programs as well. And so we'll see where it takes us. But, you know, I think a climate report just came out recently that says that we're heating the planet even faster than expected, and the efforts are falling far short of goals internationally, the U.S. playing a major role in that. And that means, in theory anyway, that the mosquito line could move up faster than expected. So that narrows the window a little bit. But there is a window still, it sounds like, and they're moving as fast as they can to do something about it.
So what is the advice you would give people who may hear this or read your article as well? How can they get involved and how can they support this project?
The Civil Beat, you know, we're a nonprofit and are depend on members and supporters to do this kind of work that brings these kind of stories to the public. Then there's the Maui Forest Bird Recovery Project, which is doing another nonprofit, which is the ones actually in the field doing these things. As I mentioned, they encourage donations, they encourage letter campaign writing, they encourage volunteers just planting trees. Planting native trees seems to be the number one thing that everyone has kind of recommended. And then there's, of course, American Bird Conservancy and others who are all working together on this.
So where does everyone plant their trees? In their back garden, or do they go over to Maui, or how does it work planting a tree?
Well, I think even if it's in your own backyard, the consensus is that can help slow the effects of climate change, sucking up some of that carbon dioxide. But at the middle elevations on Maui, if they get real specific, that can be helpful, they said. One of the guys from American Bird Conservancy, is the Hawaii director, Chris Farmer, has put this picture in my mind that I just can't get over. And he's like, well, just imagine if we can do something about the mosquitoes and we have the forest ready for them, for the birds. Imagine the ivy and these apapana and these forest birds like in your backyard, the way it used to be before humans kind of pushed them all out. And I'm just like, well, I can't imagine an ivy, which is this little scarlet forest bird with a long curved bill. I can't imagine that in my backyard. And that's kind of sad. I can imagine doves and pigeons, but I can't imagine that. But he said that could in turn then kind of shift the tide on the public's, I guess, willingness or eagerness to care and to do something, because they'll have this opportunity to connect with these birds that's not like how they are unable to now.
It's interesting, you know, I mean, it feels like even though it's had this major setback recently with the mosquitoes, it feels like a very positive world that you're in at the moment. Now, maybe that's because we've hit rock bottom and the only way to go is up, but at least people are starting to really work on these things. And there seems to be more support for projects than perhaps there was, say, 10 or 15 years ago. I mean, I really hope so. Personally, you know, I really hope we can carry on doing some work and helping you out. We've got a few ideas which we will talk to you about at some point. I'd love to come over and to Hawaii at some point, but then part of me just thinks, well, you know, your carbon footprint coming over sort of is almost negates the positive action of coming over. So, you know, we'll just have to see and play that one by ear. And as for you, you're going to stay with the Kiwi Q, I take it. Are there any more showerless nights and days?
Not between now and the holidays. I'll be working on follow-ups to the Kiwi Q, mosquitoes. And then also, I'd like to do a piece that looks at some of the other forest birds that are out there that are also endangered, maybe not to the same levels, but that are also would face the same consequences as the Kiwi Q, but would also benefit from the same conservation and restoration efforts. So I'd like to shed a quick light on those and then go from there and see where it takes me.
Well, that's the thing. You know, I always find that birds lead you to the strangest of places. I've been to the end of motorways. I literally went, we had glossy ibis over here and I had never seen one. And I drove down this road and it was the end of a motorway. And I just stopped at the end of it, got out, and off I went to find the birds. So they do take you to the strangest places, that's for sure. Well, I'd like to say it's been fantastic talking to you. You are definitely going to be bestowed the honour of officially being a Gonservationist. And before you go, I'd love you to teach me a little bit of Hawaiian.
Well, before that, I also just wanted to say thank you for, and you and Sadie and Ralph for the efforts that you guys put forth from this random reporter in the middle of the Pacific who was just sent an email one night. So I really appreciate all those efforts, the willingness to chat, and also your own individual passions, of course. So thank you, or mahalo, as we would say out here.
Mahalo.
Yeah, that would be thank you. Yeah, mahalo.
Mahalo. Okay, I'm going to use that all day or all night here. But okay, I just want to say thank you. Good luck with everything. Where's the best place to send people website-wise? Do you want to give an address out?
Oh, absolutely. Thanks. It's www.civilbeat, as in be civil, and then as in beat, B-E-A-T, .org.
Fantastic. Go and read all the work that's been going on this project. Once again, thank you very much, and I look forward to speaking to you soon, and we'll have more plans together.
Likewise. Aloha.
Gonservation Conversations is presented by me, Kerry Levy. Our series editor is Leon Rachinsky-Gorman. Our producer is Jackie Anklin. Our executive producers are Ralph Steadman and Sadie Williams. Our series consultant producer is Gary Hayes. Music by Leon Rachinsky-Gorman, lyrics by me. Find out more about Gonservation and Gonservation Conversations at gonservation.com and on Instagram and Twitter at gonservation. Gonservation Conversations is produced as part of the Highway 61 network, supporting independent producers. For more information and podcasts like this one, visit highway61.media or highway61_podcasts on Instagram and Twitter.